Chapter 10. Jerusalem, March 22nd. The army colonel waiting near the walls of the old city did not look much like Ari Shamran, but then Gabriel did not find this at all surprising. There was something about Israel, the sunlight, the intense social cohesiveness, the crackling tension of the atmosphere, that had the power to dramatically alter the appearance of its citizenry, even within the space of a single generation. Yonatan Shamran was 6 inches taller than his famous father, strikingly handsome, and possessed none of the old man's natural physical defensiveness, a result, Gabriel knew, of having been raised here instead of Poland. Only when the colonel leapt from the armored jeep and advanced on Gabriel with his hand out like a trench knife did Gabriel catch a faint glimpse of Shamran the Elder. His gait was not so much a walk as a death charge, and when he shook Gabriel's hand fiercely and clapped him between the shoulder blades, Gabriel felt as though he'd been struck by a chunk of Herodian stone. They set out along Road Number 1, the old border between East and West Jerusalem. Ramallah, the nominal seat of Palestinian power, lay just 10 miles to the north. A checkpoint appeared before them. On the opposite side lay the Kalandia refugee camp, 10,000 Palestinians piled into a few hundred square yards of breeze-block apartments. To the right, spread over a small hill, were the orderly red roofs of the Sagot Jewish settlement. Rising above it all was an enormous portrait of Yasser Arafat. The inscription, in Arabic, read, "Always with you." Yonatan jerked his thumb toward the back seat and said, "Put those things on." Gabriel, looking over his shoulder, saw an armored vest with a high collar and a metal combat helmet. He'd not worn a helmet since his brief stint in the IDF. The one Yonatan had brought along was too big, and it fell forward over his eyes. "Now you look like a real soldier," Yonatan said. Then he smiled. "Well, almost." An infantryman waved them through the checkpoint, then, seeing who was behind the wheel, smiled and said, "Hey, Yonatan!" Discipline within the ranks of the IDF, like the office, was notoriously lax. First names were the norm, and a salute was almost unheard of. Gabriel, through his cloudy, bulletproof window, studied the scene on the other side of the checkpoint. A pair of soldiers, weapons leveled, were ordering men to open their coats and lift their shirts to make certain they weren't wearing bomb belts beneath their clothing. Women underwent the same search behind a barrier that shielded them from the eyes of their men. Beyond the checkpoint snaked a line several hundred yards in length, a wait, Gabriel calculated, of 3 to 4 hours. The suicide bombers had inflicted misery on both sides of the green line, but it was the honest Palestinians, the workers trying to get to jobs in Israel, the farmers who wanted only to sell their produce, who had paid the highest price in sheer inconvenience. Gabriel looked beyond the checkpoint, toward the separation fence. "What do you think of it?" Yonatan asked. "It's certainly nothing to be proud of. I think it's an ugly scar across this beautiful land of ours. It's our new wailing wall, much longer than the first, and different, because now people are wailing on both sides of the wall. But I'm afraid we have no other choice. With good intelligence, we've managed to stop most of the suicide attacks, but we'll never be able to stop them all. We need this fence." "But it's not the only reason we're building it." "That's true," Yonatan said. "When it's finished, it will allow us to turn our backs on the Arabs and walk away. That's why they're so afraid of it. It's in their interest to remain chained to us in conflict. The wall will let us disengage, and that's the last thing they want." Road Number 1 turned to Highway 60, a ribbon of smooth black asphalt that ran northward through the dusty gray landscape of the West Bank. More than 30 years had passed since Gabriel had last been to Ramallah. Then, as now, he had come by way of armored vehicle with an IDF helmet on his head. Those early years of the occupation had been relatively calm. Indeed, Gabriel's biggest challenge each week had been finding a ride from his post back home to his mother's house in the Jezreel Valley. For most West Bank Arabs, the end of Jordanian occupation had led to a marked improvement in the quality of their lives. With the Israelis had come access to a vibrant economy, running water, electricity, and education. Infant mortality rates, once among the highest in the world, plummeted. Literacy rates, among the world's lowest, increased dramatically. Radical Islam and the influence of the PLO would eventually turn the West Bank into a seething cauldron and place IDF soldiers in daily confrontations with rock-throwing children. But for Gabriel, army service had been largely an exercise in boredom.
"So, you're going to see the irrelevant one," said Yonatan, intruding on Gabriel's thoughts.
"Your father arranged a meeting for me."
"The man's 75 years old, and he's still pulling the strings like a puppet master."
Yonatan smiled and shook his head.
"Why doesn't he just retire and take it easy?"
"He'd go insane," said Gabriel, "and so would your poor mother. He asked me to say hello to you, by the way. He'd like you to come to Tiberias for Shabbat."
"I'm on duty,"
Yonatan said hastily. Duty, it seemed, was Yonatan's ready-made excuse to avoid spending time with his father. Gabriel was reluctant to involve himself in the tangled internal disputes of the Shamron family, yet he knew how badly the old man had been hurt by the estrangement of his children. He had a selfish motive for intervention as well. If Yonatan were a larger presence in Shamron's life, it might relieve some of the pressure on Gabriel. Now that Gabriel was living in Jerusalem instead of Venice, Shamron felt free to telephone at all hours to swap office gossip or dissect the latest political developments. Gabriel needed his space back. Yonatan, if skillfully handled, could act as a sort of separation fence.
"He wants to see more of you, Yonatan."
"I can only take him in small doses."
Yonatan took his eyes from the road a moment to look at Gabriel.
"Besides, he always liked you better."
"You know that's not true."
"All right, so it's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's not all that far from the truth. He certainly thinks of you as a son."
"Your father's a great man."
"Yes," Yonatan said, "and great men are hard on their sons."
Gabriel glimpsed a pair of large, tan-colored armored personnel carriers parked ahead of them at the edge of the road.
"It's best not to enter town without a bit of muscle," Yonatan said.
They formed a small convoy, with Yonatan's jeep in the middle position, and drove on. The first evidence of the approaching city was the stream of Arabs walking along the edge of the highway. The hijabs of the women fluttered like pennants in the midday breeze. Then Ramallah, low and drab, rose out of the arid landscape. Jerusalem Street bore them into the heart of the city. The faces of the martyrs glared at Gabriel from every passing lamppost. There were streets named for the dead, squares and markets for the dead. A kiosk dispensed keychains with faces of the dead attached. An Arab moved among the traffic, hawking a martyr's calendar. The newest posters bore the seductive image of a beautiful young girl, the Arab teenager who had detonated herself in the Ben Yehuda Mall two nights previously. Yonatan turned right into Broadcast Street, and it followed for about a mile, until they reached a roadblock manned by a half-dozen Palestinian security officers. Ramallah was technically under Palestinian control again. Gabriel had come at the invitation of the authority's president, the equivalent of entering a Sicilian village with the blessing of the local don. There was little tension in evidence as Yonatan, in fluent Arabic, spoke to the leader of the Palestinian detail. Several minutes elapsed while the Palestinian consulted with his superiors over a handheld radio. Then he tapped the roof of the jeep and waved them forward.
"Slowly, Colonel Shamron," he cautioned. "Some of these boys were here the night the Egot's battalion broke down the gate and started shooting up the place. We wouldn't want there to be any misunderstandings."
Yonatan weaved his way through a maze of concrete barriers, then accelerated gently. A cement wall, about 12 feet in height and pockmarked by heavy-caliber machine gun fire, appeared on their right. In places, it had been knocked down, so that the effect was of a mouth of bad teeth. Palestinian security units, some in pickup trucks, others in jeeps, patrolled the perimeter. They eyed Gabriel and Yonatan provocatively, but kept their weapons down. Yonatan braked to a halt at the entrance. Gabriel removed his helmet and body armor. Yonatan asked,
"How long will you be?"
"That depends on him, I suppose."
Prepare yourself for a tirade. He's usually in a foul mood these days.
Who could blame him?
He has only himself to blame, Gabriel. Remember that.
Gabriel opened the door and climbed out.
Are you going to be all right here alone?
No problem, Yonatan said. Then he waved to Gabriel and said,
Give him my best.
A Palestinian security officer greeted Gabriel through the bars of the gate. He wore an olive drab uniform, a flat cap, and a black patch over his left eye. He opened the gate wide enough for Gabriel to pass and beckoned him forward. His hand was missing the last three fingers. On the other side of the gate, Gabriel was set upon by two more uniformed men who subjected him to a rigorous and intrusive body search, while One Eye looked on, grinning as though the whole thing had been arranged for his private amusement. One Eye introduced himself as Colonel Kemmel and led Gabriel into the compound. It was not the first time Gabriel had set foot in the Mukatta. During the Mandate period, it had been a British army fortress. After the Six-Day War, the IDF had taken it over from the Jordanians and used it throughout the occupation as a West Bank command post. Gabriel, when he was a soldier, had often reported for duty in the same place, Yasser Arafat, now used as his headquarters. Arafat's office was located in a square, two-story building huddled against the northern wall of the Mukatta. Heavily damaged, it was one of the few buildings still standing in the compound. In the lobby, Gabriel endured a second search, this time at the hands of a mustachioed giant in plain clothes with a compact submachine gun across his chest. The search complete, the security man nodded to Colonel Kemmel, who prodded Gabriel up a narrow flight of stairs. On the landing, seated on a fragile-looking chair balanced precariously on two legs, was another security man. He cast Gabriel an apathetic glance, then reached up and rapped his knuckle against the wooden door. An irritated voice on the other side said, Come! Colonel Kemmel turned the latch and led Gabriel inside. The office Gabriel entered was not much larger than his own at King Saul Boulevard. There was a modest wood desk and a small camp bed with a handsome leather-bound copy of the Quran lying atop the starched white pillowcase. Heavy velveteen curtains covered the window. A desk lamp angled severely downward toward a stack of paperwork was the only source of light. Along one wall, almost lost in the heavy shadows, hung row upon row of framed photographs showing the Palestinian leader with many famous people, including the American president, who had bestowed de facto recognition upon his miniature state, and whom Arafat had rewarded by stabbing in the back at Camp David and walking away from a peace deal. Behind the desk, elfin and sickly-looking, sat Arafat himself. He wore a pressed uniform and a black-and-white checkered kafia. As usual, it was draped over his right shoulder and secured to the front of his uniform in such a way that it resembled the land of Palestine. Arafat's version of Palestine, Gabriel noted, for it looked very much like the State of Israel. His hand, when he gestured for Gabriel to sit, shook violently, as did his pouting lower lip when he asked Gabriel whether he wished to have tea. Gabriel knew enough of Arab custom to realize that a refusal would get things off on the wrong foot, so he readily accepted the tea and watched with a certain amount of pleasure as Arafat dispatched Colonel Kemmel to fetch it. Alone for the first time, they eyed each other silently over the small desk. The shadow of their last encounter hung over them. It had taken place in the study of a Manhattan apartment where Tariq al-Hureini, the same man who had planted a bomb beneath Gabriel's car in Vienna, had tried to murder Arafat for his supposed betrayal of the Palestinian people. Tariq, before fleeing the apartment house, had put a bullet into Gabriel's chest, a wound that very nearly killed him. Seated now in Arafat's presence, Gabriel's chest ached for the first time in many years. No single person, other than perhaps Shamron, had influenced the course of Gabriel's life more than Yasser Arafat. For 30 years, they had been swimming together in the same river of blood. Gabriel had killed Arafat's most trusted lieutenants.
Arafat had ordered the reprisal against Gabriel in Vienna. But were Leah and Danny the targets, or had the bomb actually been meant for him? Gabriel had been obsessed by the question for 13 years. Arafat certainly knew the answer. It was one of the reasons why Gabriel had so readily accepted Shamron's suggestion to visit Ramallah.
"Shamron said you wished to discuss an important matter with me," Arafat said. "I agreed to see you only as a courtesy to him. We are the same age, Shamron and I. History threw us together in this land, and unfortunately we have fought many battles. Sometimes I got the better of him, sometimes he bested me. Now we are both growing old. I had hopes we might see a few days of peace before we died. My hopes are fading."
If that was the case, thought Gabriel, why then did you walk away from a deal that would have given you a state in Gaza and 97% of the West Bank with East Jerusalem as its capital? Gabriel knew the answer, of course. It was evidenced in the cloth map of Palestine Arafat wore on his shoulder. He'd wanted it all. Gabriel had no chance to respond, because Colonel Kemmel returned holding a small silver tray with 2 glasses of tea. The colonel then settled himself in a chair and glared at Gabriel with his one good eye. Arafat explained that the aide spoke fluent Hebrew and would assist with any translation. Gabriel had hoped to meet with Arafat alone, but a translator would probably prove useful. Gabriel's Arabic, while passable, did not possess the nuance or flexibility necessary for a conversation with a man like Yasser Arafat. Arafat, with a trembling hand, placed his glass of tea back into its saucer and asked Gabriel what had brought him to Ramallah. Gabriel's one-word answer left Arafat momentarily off balance, just as Gabriel had intended.
"Khaled?" Arafat repeated, recovering his footing. "I know many men named Khaled. I'm afraid it is a rather common Palestinian name. You'll have to be more specific."
Feigned ignorance, Gabriel well knew, was one of Arafat's favorite negotiating tactics. Gabriel pressed his case.
"The Khaled I'm looking for, Chairman Arafat, is Khaled al-Khalifa."
"President Arafat," said the Palestinian.
Gabriel nodded indifferently.
"Where is Khaled al-Khalifa?"
The blotchy skin of Arafat's face colored suddenly, and his lower lip began to tremble. Gabriel looked down and contemplated his tea. From the corner of his eye, he noticed Colonel Kemmel shifting nervously in his seat. Arafat, when he spoke again, managed to keep his legendary temper in check.
"I take it you're referring to the son of Sabri al-Khalifa?"
"Actually, he's your son now."
"My adopted son," Arafat said. "Because you murdered his father."
"His father was killed on the field of battle."
"He was murdered in cold blood on the streets of Paris."
"It was Sabri who turned Paris into a battlefield, President Arafat, with your blessing."
A silence fell between them. Arafat seemed to choose his next words carefully.
"I always knew that one day you would come up with some sort of provocation to target Khaled for elimination. That's why, after Sabri's funeral, I sent the boy far away from here. I gave him a new life, and he took it. I haven't seen or heard from Khaled since he was a young man."
"We have evidence to suggest Khaled al-Khalifa was involved in the attack on our embassy in Rome."
"Nonsense," said Arafat dismissively.
"Since Khaled had nothing to do with Rome, I'm sure you wouldn't mind telling us where we can find him."
"As I said before, I don't know where Khaled is."
"What's his name?"
A guarded smile.
"I went to extraordinary lengths to protect the boy from you and your vengeful service. What on earth makes you think I would tell you his name now? Do you really believe that I would play the role of Judas Iscariot and hand over my son to you for trial and execution?"
Arafat shook his head slowly.
"We have many traitors in our midst, many who work right here in Mukata.
but I am not one of them. If you want to find Khaled, you'll do it without my help."
There was a raid on a pensione in Milan shortly after the bombing. One of the men hiding there was named Daoud Hadawi, a Palestinian who used to be a member of your presidential security service.
So you say.
I would appreciate a copy of Hadawi's personnel file.
Several hundred men work in the presidential security service. If this man, he faltered, what was his name?
Daoud Hadawi.
Ah, yes, Hadawi. If he ever worked for this service, and if we still have a personnel file on him, I'll be glad to give it to you. But I think the odds of us finding something are rather slim.
Really?
Let me make this clear to you, Arafat said. We Palestinians had nothing to do with the attack on your embassy. Maybe it was Hezbollah or Osama. Maybe it was neo-Nazis. God knows you have many enemies.
Gabriel placed his palms on the arms of the chair and prepared to stand. Arafat raised his hand.
Please, Jibril, he said, using the Arabic version of Gabriel's name. Don't leave yet. Stay a little longer.
Gabriel, for the moment, relented. Arafat fidgeted with his kafia, then looked at Colonel Kemmel and in quiet Arabic instructed him to leave them alone.
You have not touched your tea, Jibril. Can I get you something else? Some sweets, perhaps?
Gabriel shook his head. Arafat folded his tiny hands and regarded Gabriel in silence. He was smiling slightly. Gabriel had the distinct sense Arafat was enjoying himself.
I know what you did for me in New York a few years ago. If it weren't for you, Tariq might very well have killed me in that apartment. In another time, you might have hoped for him to succeed.
A wistful smile.
Who knows? In another time, it might have been you, Jibril, standing there with a gun in your hand.
Gabriel made no reply. Kill Arafat? In the weeks after Vienna, when he had been unable to picture anything but the charred flesh of his wife and the mutilated body of his son, he had thought about it many times. Indeed, at his lowest point, Gabriel would gladly have traded his own life for Arafat's.
It's strange, Jibril, but for a brief time, we were allies, you and I. We both wanted peace. We both needed peace.
Did you ever want peace? Or was it all part of your phased strategy to destroy Israel and take the whole thing? This time it was Arafat who allowed a question to hang in the air unanswered.
I owe you my life, Jibril, and so I will help you in this matter. There is no Khaled. Khaled is a figment of your imagination. If you keep chasing him, the real killers will escape.
Gabriel stood abruptly, terminating the meeting. Arafat came out from behind the desk and placed his hands on Gabriel's shoulders. Gabriel's flesh seemed ablaze, but he did nothing to sever the Palestinian's embrace.
I'm glad we finally met formally, Arafat said. If you and I can sit down together in peace, perhaps there's hope for us all.
Perhaps, said Gabriel, though his tone revealed his pessimism. Arafat released Gabriel and started toward the door, then stopped himself suddenly.
You surprise me, Jibril.
Why is that?
I expected you to use this opportunity to clear the air about Vienna.
You murdered my wife and son, Gabriel said deliberately, misleading Arafat over Leah's fate. I'm not sure we'll ever be able to clear the air, as you put it. Arafat shook his head.
No, Jibril, I didn't murder them. I ordered Tariq to kill you to avenge Abu Jihad, but I specifically told him that your family was not to be touched.
Why did you do that?
Because you deserved it. You conducted yourself with a certain honor that night in Tunis. Yes, you killed Abu Jihad, but you made certain no harm came to his wife and children. In fact, you stopped on the way out of the villa to comfort Abu Jihad's daughter and instruct her to look after her mother. Do you remember that, Jibril? Gabriel closed his eyes and nodded. The scene in Tunis, like the bombing in Vienna, hung in a gallery of memory that he walked each night in his dreams.
"I felt you deserved the same as Abu Jihad, to die a soldier's death witnessed by your wife and child. Tariq didn't agree with me. He felt you deserved a more severe punishment, the punishment of watching your wife and child die. So he planted the bomb beneath their car and made certain you were on hand to witness the detonation. Vienna was Tariq's doing, not mine."
The telephone on Arafat's desk rang, tearing Gabriel's memory of Vienna as a knife shreds canvas. Arafat turned suddenly and left Gabriel to see himself out. Colonel Kemmel was waiting on the landing. He escorted Gabriel wordlessly through the debris of the Mukata. The harsh light, after the gloom of Arafat's office, was nearly unbearable. Beyond the broken gate, Yonatan Shamron was playing football with a few of the Palestinian guards. They climbed back into the armored jeep and drove through streets of death. When they were clear of Ramallah, Yonatan asked Gabriel whether he had learned anything useful.
"Khaled al-Khalifa bombed our embassy in Rome," Gabriel said with certainty.
"Anything else?"
"Yes," he thought. Yasser Arafat had personally ordered Tariq al-Hirani to murder his wife and son. Chapter 11. Jerusalem, March 23rd. Gabriel's bedside telephone rang at 2 a.m. It was Yaakov.
"Looks like your visit to the Mukata has stirred the hornet's nest."
"What are you talking about?"
"I'm outside in the street."
The connection went dead. Gabriel sat up in bed and dressed in the dark.
"Who was that?"
Kiara asked, her voice heavy with sleep. Gabriel told her.
"What is it?"
"I don't know."
"Where are you going?"
"I don't know." He bent to kiss her forehead. Kiara's arm rose from the blankets, curled around the back of his neck, and drew him to her mouth.
"Be careful," she whispered,
her lips against his cheek. A moment later, he was buckled into the passenger seat of Yaakov's unmarked Volkswagen Golf, racing westward across Jerusalem. Yaakov drove ludicrously fast, in true Sabra fashion, with the wheel in one hand and coffee and a cigarette in the other. The headlamps of the oncoming traffic threw an unkind light on the pockmarked features of his uncompromising face.
"His name is Mahmoud Arwish," Yaakov said. "One of our most important assets inside the Palestinian Authority. He works in the Mukata, very close to Arafat."
"Who made the approach?"
"Arwish sent up a flare a couple of hours ago and said he wanted to talk."
"About what?"
"Khaled, of course."
"What does he know?"
"He wouldn't say."
"Why do you need me? Why isn't he talking to his controller?"
"I'm his controller," Yaakov said. "But the person he really wants to talk to is you."
They had reached the western edge of the new city. To Gabriel's right, bathed in the silver light of a newly risen moon, lay the flatlands of the West Bank. Old hands called it Shabak country. It was a land where the usual rules did not apply, and where the few conventions that did exist could be bent or broken whenever it was deemed necessary to combat Arab terror. Men such as Yaakov were the mailed fist of Israeli security, foot soldiers who engaged in the dirty work of counter-terrorism. Shabakniks had the power to arrest without cause and search without warrants, to shut down businesses and dynamite houses. They lived on nerves and nicotine, drank too much coffee and slept too little. Their wives left them. Their Arab informants feared and hated them. Gabriel, though he had dispensed the ultimate sanction of the state, always considered himself fortunate that he had been asked to join the office and not Shabak. Shabak's methods were sometimes at odds with the principles of a democratic state, and, like the office, public scandals had damaged its reputation both at home and abroad. The worst was the infamous Bus 300 affair. In April 1984, Bus number 300, en route from Tel Aviv to the southern city of Ashkelon, was hijacked by four Palestinians. Two were killed during the military rescue operation. The two surviving terrorists were led into a nearby wheat field and never seen again. Later it was revealed that the hijackers had been beaten to death by Shabak officers acting under orders from their director general. A series of scandals followed in quick succession, each exposing some of Shabak's most ruthless methods: violence, coerced confessions, blackmail, and deception. Shabak's defenders were fond of saying that interrogations of suspected terrorists cannot be conducted over a pleasant cup of coffee. Its goals, regardless of the scandals, remained unchanged. Shabak was not interested in catching terrorists after blood was shed. It wanted to stop the terrorists before they could strike, and, if possible, to frighten young Arabs from ever going the way of violence. Yakov applied the brakes suddenly to avoid colliding with a slow-moving transit van. Simultaneously, he flashed his lights and pounded on the car horn. The van responded by changing lanes. As Yakov shot past, Gabriel glimpsed a pair of Haradim conducting an animated conversation as though nothing had happened. Yakov tossed a kippah onto Gabriel's lap. It was larger than most and loosely knitted, with an orange and amber pattern against a black background. Gabriel understood the significance of its design.
"We'll cross the line as settlers, just in case anyone from PA Security or Hamas is watching the checkpoints."
"Where are we from?"
"Kiryat Devora," Yakov replied. "It's in the Jordan Valley. We're never going to set foot there."
Gabriel held up the skullcap.
"I take it we're not terribly popular with the local population?"
"Let's just say that the residents of Kiryat Devora take their commitment to the land of Israel quite seriously."
Gabriel slipped the kippah onto his head and adjusted the angle. Yakov briefed Gabriel as he drove, the procedures for crossing into the West Bank, the route they would take to the Arab village where Arwish was waiting, the method of extraction. When Yakov finished, he reached into the back seat and produced an Uzi miniature submachine gun.
"I prefer this," said Gabriel, holding up his Beretta.
Yakov laughed.
"Oh, this is the West Bank, not the Left Bank. Don't be a fool, Gabriel. Take the Uzi."
Gabriel reluctantly took the weapon and rammed a magazine of ammunition into the butt. Yakov covered his head with a kippah identical to the one he'd given Gabriel. A few miles beyond Ben-Gurion Airport, he exited the motorway and followed a two-lane road eastward toward the West Bank. The separation fence, looming before them, cast a black shadow across the landscape. At the checkpoint, a Shabak man stood among the IDF soldiers. As Yakov approached, the Shabak man murmured a few words to the soldiers, and the Volkswagen was allowed to pass without inspection. Yakov, clear of the checkpoint, raced along the moon-washed road at high speed. Gabriel glanced over his shoulder and saw a pair of headlights. The lights floated there for a time, then receded into the night. Yakov seemed to take no notice of them. The second car, Gabriel suspected, belonged to a Shabak counter-surveillance team. A sign warned that Ramallah lay 4 kilometers ahead. Yakov turned off the road onto a dirt track that ran through the bed of an ancient wadi. He doused his headlamps and navigated the wadi with only the amber glow of his parking lights. After a moment, he brought the car to a stop.
"Open the glove box."
Gabriel did as he was told. Inside was a pair of kafias.
"You've got to be kidding."
"Cover your face," Yakov said. "All of it, the way they do."
Yakov, in a practiced motion, bound his head in the kafia and tied it at his throat so that his face was concealed except for a thin slit for his eyes. Gabriel did the same. Yakov started driving again, plunging along the darkened wadi with both hands wrapped around the wheel, leaving Gabriel with the uncomfortable feeling he was seated next to an Arab militant on a suicide run. A mile farther on, they came to a narrow, paved road. Yakov turned onto the road and followed it north. The village was small, even by West Bank standards, and gripped by an air of sudden desertion. A collection of squat, dun-colored houses crouched around the narrow spire of a minaret, with scarcely a light burning anywhere. In the center of the village lay a small market square. There were no other cars and no pedestrians, only a flock of goats nosing amid fallen produce. The house where Yakov stopped was on the northern edge. The window facing the street was shuttered. One of the shutters hung aslant from a broken hinge. A few feet from the front door was a child's tricycle. The bike was pointed toward the door, which meant the meeting was still on. Had it been pointed in the opposite direction, they would have been forced to abort and head for the backup location. Yakov snatched an Uzi submachine gun from the floorboard and climbed out of the car. Gabriel did the same, then pulled open the rear passenger side door just as Yakov had instructed. He turned his back to the house and watched the street for any sign of movement.
"If anyone approaches the car while I'm inside, shoot in their direction," Yakov had said. "If they don't get the message, put them on the ground."
Yakov hurdled the tricycle and drove his right foot against the door. Gabriel heard the crack of splintering wood, but kept his eyes trained on the street. From inside came the sound of a voice shouting in Arabic. Gabriel recognized it as Yakov's. The next voice was unfamiliar to him. A light appeared in a nearby cottage, then another. Gabriel released the safety on his Uzi and slipped his forefinger inside the trigger guard. He heard footfalls behind him and turned in time to see Yakov leading Arwish through the broken door, hands in the air, face shrouded by a black hood, an Uzi pressed to the back of his head. Gabriel turned his gaze once more toward the street. A man, dressed in a pale gray galabia, had stepped outside his cottage and was shouting at Gabriel in Arabic. Gabriel, in the same language, ordered him to stay back, but the Palestinian advanced closer.
"Shoot at him!"
Yakov snapped, but Gabriel calmly held fire. Yakov shoved Arwish headlong into the back of the car. Gabriel scrambled in after him and drove the informant toward the floor. Yakov ran around the front of the car to the driver's side door, pausing long enough to spray a volley of rounds a few yards from the feet of the Palestinian villager, who scurried back into the shelter of his house. Yakov jumped behind the wheel, then reversed down the narrow street. Reaching the market square, he turned around and sped through the village. The gunfire and the roaring of the car engine had alerted the villagers to trouble. Faces appeared in windows and doorways, but no one dared challenge them. Gabriel kept watch out the rear window until the village vanished into the darkness. A moment later, Yakov was once again racing along the rutted wadi, this time in the opposite direction. The collaborator was still pressed to the floor, wedged into the narrow space between the back seat and the front.
"Let me up, you jackass!"
Gabriel pressed his forearm against the side of the Arab's neck and subjected his body to a rough and thorough search for weapons or explosives. Finding nothing, he pulled the Arab onto the seat and tore away the black hood. A single eye glared malevolently back at him, the eye of Yasser Arafat's translator, Colonel Kemmel. The city of Hedera, an early Zionist farm settlement turned drab Israeli industrial town, lies on the coastal plain halfway between Haifa and Tel Aviv. In a working-class section of the city, adjacent to a sprawling tire factory, stands a row of wheat-colored apartment buildings. One of the buildings, the one nearest the factory, stinks always of burning rubber. On the top floor of this building is a Shabak safe flat. For most officers, it is a meeting place of last resort. Yakov actually preferred it. The acrid smell, he believed, lent an air of urgency to the proceedings, for few men who came here wished to linger long. But then Yakov was driven by other ghosts. His great-grandparents, Russian Jews from Kovno, had been among the founders of Hedera. They had turned a worthless, malarial swamp into productive farmland. For Yakov, Hedera was truth. Hedera was Israel. The flat was devoid of comfort. The sitting room was furnished with folding metal chairs, and the linoleum floor was buckled and bare. On the kitchen counter stood a cheap plastic electric kettle. In the rust-stained basin, a quartet of dirty cups. Mahmoud Arwish, alias Colonel Kemmel, had turned down Yakov's rather disingenuous offer of tea. He had also requested that Yakov leave the lights off. The neatly pressed uniform he'd been wearing that morning at the Mukata had been replaced by a pair of gabardine trousers and a white cotton shirt, which glowed softly in the moonlight streaming through the window. Between the two remaining fingers of his right hand rested one of Yakov's American cigarettes. With the other hand, he was massaging the side of his neck. His single eye was fixed on Gabriel, who had forsaken his folding chair and was seated on the floor with his back propped against the wall and his legs crossed before him. Yakov was a formless shadow against the window.
"I see you've learned a thing or two from your Shabak friend," Arwish said, rubbing his jaw. "They have a reputation for being good with their fists."
"You said you wanted to see me," said Gabriel. "I don't like when people ask to see me."
"What did you think I was planning to do, kill you?"
"It's not without precedent," Gabriel replied calmly.
Shabak agents, he knew, were at their most vulnerable while meeting with assets from the other side. In recent years, several had been killed during meetings. One had been hacked to death with an axe in a Jerusalem safe flat.
"If we'd wanted to kill you, we'd have done it this morning in Ramallah. Our people would have celebrated your death. Your hands are stained with the blood of Palestinian heroes."
"Celebration of death is what you're good at these days," Gabriel replied. "Sometimes it seems to be the only thing. Offer your people something instead of suicide. Lead them instead of following the most extreme elements of your society. Build something."
"We tried to build something," Arwish replied, "and you tore it down with your tanks and bulldozers."
Gabriel glimpsed Yakov's shadow stirring in the window. The Shabak man wanted the topic moved onto less contentious ground. Mahmoud Arwish, judging from the menacing manner in which he lit a second cigarette, was not ready to concede. Gabriel looked away from the Arab's single glaring eye and absently trailed his forefinger through the dust on the linoleum floor. "Let him rant," Shamron would have counseled. "Let him cast you as the oppressor and villain. It helps to assuage the guilt of betrayal."
"Yes, we celebrate death," Arwish said,
closing the lid of Yakov's old-fashioned lighter with a snap.
"And some of us collaborate with our enemy. But that's the way it always is in war, isn't it? Unfortunately, we Palestinians are easily bought. Shabak calls it the three Ks. Kesef, Kavod, Kusit. Money, respect, woman. Imagine betraying your people for the affection of an Israeli whore."
Gabriel, silent, continued doodling in the dust. He realized he was tracing the outline of a Caravaggio, Abraham, knife in hand, preparing to slay his own son in service to the Lord. Arwish went on.
"Do you know why I collaborate, Jibril? I collaborate because my wife became ill. The doctor at the clinic in Ramallah diagnosed her with cancer and said she would die unless she received treatment in Jerusalem. I requested permission from the Israeli authorities to enter the city, which brought me into contact with Shabak and my dear friend."
He inclined his head toward Yakov, who was now seated on the window ledge with his arms folded.
"In front of me, he calls himself Solomon. I know his real name is Yakov, but I always refer to him as Solomon. It is one of the many games we play."
Arwish contemplated the end of his cigarette.
"Needless to say, my wife received permission to travel to Jerusalem for treatment. But it came at a steep price. The price of collaboration. Solomon jails my sons from time to time, just to keep the information flowing. He's even jailed a relative who lives on the Israeli side of the Green Line. But when Solomon truly wants to turn the screws on me, he threatens to tell my wife of my treachery. Solomon knows. She would never forgive me."
Gabriel looked up from his Caravaggio. "Are you finished?"
"Yes, I think so."
"Then why don't you tell me about Khaled?"
"Khaled?" Arwish repeated, shaking his head. "Khaled is the least of your problems."
He paused and looked toward the darkened ceiling.
"Israel is bewildered. They have now become among the nations like an unwanted vessel, like a lonely wild ass."
His gaze settled on Gabriel once more.
"Do you know who wrote those words?"
"Hosea,"
Gabriel replied indifferently.
"Correct," said Arwish. "Are you a religious man?"
"No," answered Gabriel truthfully.
"Neither am I," confessed Arwish. "But perhaps you should heed the advice of Hosea.
What is Israel's solution to her problem with the Palestinians? To build a fence. To act, in the words of Hosea, like shifters of field boundaries. The Jews complain bitterly about the centuries they spent in the ghetto. And yet, what are you doing with that separation fence? You are building the first Palestinian ghetto. Worse still, you're building a ghetto for yourselves.
Arwish started to raise his cigarette to his lips, but Yaakov stepped away from the window and slapped the cigarette from the Palestinian's ruined hand. Arwish treated himself to the victim's superior smile. Then he twisted his head around and asked Yaakov for a cup of tea. Yaakov returned to the window and remained motionless.
No tea today, Arwish said. Only money. To get my money, I must sign Solomon's ledger and affix to it my own thumbprint. That way, if I betray Solomon, he can punish me. There is but one fate for collaboration in our part of this land. Death. And not a gentleman's death, a biblical death. I'll be stoned or hacked to pieces by Arafat's fanatical killers. That's how Yaakov ensures I tell him nothing but the truth, and on a timely basis.
Yaakov leaned forward and whispered into Arwish's ear, like a lawyer instructing a witness under hostile questioning.
Solomon grows irritated with my speeches. Solomon would like me to get down to business.
Arwish studied Gabriel for a moment.
But not you, Jibril. You are the patient one.
Gabriel looked up.
Where's Khaled? I don't know. I only know that Arafat misled you this morning. You're right. Khaled does exist, and he's taken up the sword of his father and grandfather.
Did he do Rome?
A moment of hesitation, a glance toward the dark figure of Yaakov, then a slow nod.
Is he acting at Arafat's behest?
I couldn't say for certain.
What can you say for certain?
He's in communication with the Mukata.
How?
A number of different ways. Sometimes he uses faxes. They're bounced from a number of different machines, and by the time they arrive in the territories, they're almost impossible to read.
What else?
Sometimes he uses coded emails, which are routed through a number of different addresses and servers. Sometimes he sends messages to Arafat via courier or through the visiting delegations. Most of the time, though, he just uses the telephone.
Could you identify his voice?
I'm not sure I've ever heard him speak.
Have you ever seen him?
I believe I met him once, many years ago in Tunis. A young man came to visit and stayed in Arafat's compound for a few days. He had a French name and passport, but he spoke Arabic like a Palestinian.
What makes you think it was Khaled?
The way Arafat was acting, he glowed in the presence of this young man. He was positively giddy.
That's all?
No. There was something about his appearance. They always said Khaled looked like his grandfather. This man certainly bore a striking resemblance to Sheikh Assad.
Arwish stood suddenly. Yaakov's arm swung up, and he leveled his Uzi at the Arab's head. Arwish smiled and pulled his shirt out of his trousers. Taped to his lower back was an envelope. Gabriel had missed it during his rapid search for weapons in the back of the car. Arwish removed the envelope and flipped it to Gabriel, who pried open the flap and shook the photograph out onto his lap. It showed a young man, strikingly handsome, seated next to Arafat at a table. He seemed unaware that his picture was being taken.
Arafat has a habit of secretly photographing anyone who meets with him, Arwish said. You have photographs of Khaled as a child. Perhaps your computers can confirm that this man is truly him.
It's not likely, Gabriel said.
What else do you have? When he calls the Mukata, it's not his voice on the line.
How does he do that?
He has someone else do the talking. A woman. A European woman.
What's her name?
She uses different names and different telephones.
Where? Arwish shrugged. What's her native language?
Hard to tell, but Her Arabic is perfect.
Accent?
Classical. Upper crust Jordanian. Maybe Beirut or Cairo. She refers to Khaled as Tony.
Tony who?
Gabriel asked calmly.
Tony where?
I don't know, Arwish said. But find the woman, and maybe you'll find Khaled.
Chapter 12. Tel Aviv.
She calls herself Madeleine, but only when she's posing as a French woman. When she wants to be British, she calls herself Alexandra. When Italian, she's Lunetta, Little Moon.
Natan looked at Gabriel and blinked several times. He wore his hair in a ponytail. His spectacles lay slightly askew across the end of his nose, and there were holes in his Malibu surfer's sweatshirt. Yakov had forewarned Gabriel about Natan's appearance.
He's a genius. After graduating from Caltech, every high-tech firm in America and Israel wanted him. He's a bit like you,
Yakov had concluded with the slightly envious tone of a man who did but one thing well. Gabriel looked out of Natan's glass-enclosed office onto a large, brightly lit floor lined with row upon row of computer workstations. At each station sat a technician. Most were shockingly young, and most were Mizrahim Jews who had come from Arab countries. These were the unsung warriors in Israel's war against terrorism. They never saw the enemy, never forced him to betray his people, or confronted him across an interrogation table. To them, he was a crackle of electricity down a copper wire or a whisper in the atmosphere. Natan Hafi was charged with the seemingly impossible task of monitoring all electronic communication between the outside world and the territories. Computers did the brunt of the work, sifting the intercepts for certain words, phrases, or the voices of known terrorists. Yet Natan still regarded his ears as the most reliable weapon in his arsenal.
We don't know her real name, he said. Right now she's just Voiceprint 572B. So far we've intercepted 5 telephone calls between her and Arafat. Care to listen?
Gabriel nodded. Natan clicked an icon on his computer screen, and the recordings began to play. During each call, the woman posed as a foreign peace activist, telephoning to express support for the beleaguered Palestinian leader, or to commiserate about the latest Zionist outrage. Each conversation contained a brief reference to a friend named Tony, just as Mahmoud Arwish had said. After listening to 4 of the conversations, Gabriel asked,
What can you tell about her based on her voice?
Her Arabic is excellent, but she's no Arab. French, I'd say, from the south, maybe the Marseille area. Overeducated, oversexed. She also has a small butterfly tattooed on her rear end.
Yakov looked up sharply.
I'm kidding, said Natan, but listen to intercept number 5. She's posing as our French woman, Madeleine, head of something called the Center for a Just and Lasting Peace in Palestine. The topic of the conversation is an upcoming rally in Paris.
Paris?
Gabriel asked. You're sure it's Paris? Natan nodded.
She tells Arafat that one of the organizers, a man named Tony, is predicting a turnout of 100,000. Then she hesitates and corrects herself. Tony's prediction isn't 100,000, she says. It's 200,000.
Natan played the intercept. When it was over, Yakov said,
What's so interesting about that?
This.
Natan opened another audio file and played a few seconds worth of inaudible muffle.
There was someone else in the room with her at the time. He was monitoring the conversation on another extension. When Madeleine says Tony is expecting 100,000 people, this fellow covers the mouthpiece and, in French, tells her, No, no, not 100,000. It's going to be 200,000. He thinks no one can hear him, but he's put the mouthpiece right against his vocal cords. It's a real rookie mistake. We got the vibrations on tape. With a little filtering and scrubbing, I made that garble sound like this.
Natan played the file again. This time it was audible. A man, perfect French.
No, no, not 100,000. It's going to be 200,000.
Natan clicked his mouse and pointed to the top right corner of his computer monitor, a grid pattern crisscrossed by a series of undulating lines.
This is a sound spectrograph, the voice print. It's a mathematical equation based on the physical configuration of a speaker's mouth and throat. We've compared this print with every voice print we have on file.
And?
Not a single match. We call him Voice Print 698D.
When was that call recorded?
6 weeks ago.
Do you know where the call was placed?
Natan smiled. There was a row, but then no office operation was complete without one. Lev wanted to keep Gabriel locked in the basement on punishment rations of bread and water, and he briefly held the upper hand. Gabriel was blown and no longer fit for field work, Lev argued. Besides, the telephone intercepts suggested Khaled was hiding in the Arab world, somewhere the Europhile Gabriel, except for his brief foray into Tunis, had never operated. As a last resort, Lev sought refuge in bureaucratic twaddle, arguing that Gabriel's committee possessed no foreign operational charter. The matter reached Shamron, as most matters eventually did. Lev sidestepped, but too late to ward off the fatal blow, for advice from Shamron had the authority of God's commandments chiseled in stone. Having prevailed in the bureaucratic trenches, Gabriel hurriedly dealt next with his problems of identity and appearance. He decided to travel as a German, for German was his first language and remained the language of his dreams. He chose commercial interior design as his trade, and Munich as his place of residence. Operations supplied him with a passport in the name of Johannes Klemp, and a wallet filled with credit cards and other personal paraphernalia, including business cards engraved with a Munich telephone number. The number, if dialed, would ring in an office safe flat, then transfer automatically to a switchboard inside Kingsall Boulevard, where Gabriel's recorded voice would announce that he was away on holiday and would call back upon his return. As for his appearance, the specialists in operations suggested a beard, and Gabriel, who regarded any man with facial hair as distrustful and hiding something, reluctantly complied. To his everlasting disappointment, it came in very gray. This pleased the specialists, who colored his hair to match. They added a pair of frameless rectangular spectacles and a suitcase filled with fashionable monochrome clothing from Berlin and Milan. The wizards in technical provided several innocent-looking consumer electronic devices that, in reality, were not so innocent at all. One warm evening, shortly before his departure, he dressed in one of Herr Klemp's egregious suits and stalked the discos and nightclubs along Schenken Street in Tel Aviv. Herr Klemp was all that he, and by extension Mario Del Vecchio, was not. A loquacious bore, a womanizer, a man who liked expensive drink and techno music. He loathed Herr Klemp, yet at the same time welcomed him, for Gabriel never felt truly safe unless wearing the skin of another man. He thought of his hasty preparation for Operation Wrath of God, of walking the streets of Tel Aviv with Shamron, stealing wallets and breaking into hotel rooms along the promenade. Only once had he been caught. A Romanian Jewish woman who had seized Gabriel's wrist in a Shamron-like grip and screamed for the police.
"You went like a lamb to the slaughter," Shamron had said. "What if it had been a gendarme or a carabinieri? Do you think I'd be able to walk in and demand your freedom? If they come for you, fight back. If you must shed innocent blood, then shed it without hesitation, but never allow yourself to be arrested. Never."
Office tradition demanded Gabriel spend his final night in Israel at a jump site, the in-house idiom for a departure safe flat. Without exception, they are forlorn places that stink of cigarettes and failure. So he chose instead to spend the night in Narcus Street with Chiara. Their lovemaking was strained and awkward. Afterward, Chiara confessed that Gabriel felt a stranger to her. Gabriel had never been able to sleep before an operation, and his last night in Jerusalem was no exception. And so he was pleased to hear, shortly before midnight, the distinctive grumble of Shamron's armored Peugeot pulling up outside the street, and to glimpse Shamron's bald head floating up the garden walk, with Rami at his heels. They passed the remainder of that night in Gabriel's study, with the windows open to the chill night air.
Shamron talked about the War of Independence, his search for Sheikh Assad, and of the morning he had killed him in the cottage outside Lida. As dawn approached, Gabriel felt a reluctance to leave him, a sense that perhaps he should have taken Lev's advice and allowed someone else to go in his place. Only when it had grown light outside did Shamron talk about what lay ahead.
"Don't go anywhere near the embassy," he said. "The Mukhabarat assumes, with some justification, that everyone who works there is a spy."
Then he gave Gabriel a business card.
"He's ours, bought and paid for. He knows everyone in town. I've told him to expect you. Be careful, he likes his drink."
An hour later, Gabriel climbed into an office car outfitted as a Jerusalem taxi and headed down the Bab al-Wad to Ben-Gurion Airport. He cleared customs as Herr Klemp, endured a mind-numbing security examination, then went to the departure lounge. When his flight was called, he set out across the bone-white tarmac toward the waiting jetliner and took his seat in the economy cabin. As the plane lifted off, he looked out the window and watched the land sinking beneath him, gripped by a perverse fear that he would never see it or Kiara again. He thought of the journey ahead, a week-long Mediterranean odyssey that would take him from Athens to Istanbul and finally to the ancient city on the western edge of the Fertile Crescent, where he hoped to find a woman named Madeleine, or Alexandra, or Lunetta, the little moon, and her friend named Tony.